legitimate posts to take up the shovel and sack. A few diary entries, transcribed from the anonymously written Diary of a Resurrectionist, yield some insight into the sort of people we're talking about here. Tuesday, 3rd, November, 1811. Went to look out and brought the shovels from Bartholo. Butler and me came home intoxicated. Tuesday, 10th, intoxicated all day. At night went out and got 5, Bunhill Row. Jack almost buried. Friday, 27th, went to Harp's, got 1 large, and took it to Jack's house. Jack, Bill, and Tom not with us, getting drunk. It is tempting to believe that the author's impersonal references to the corpses belie some sense of discomfort with his activities. He does not dwell upon their looks or muse about their sorry fate. He cannot bring himself to refer to the dead as anything other than a size or a gender. Only occasionally do the bodies merit a noun, most often thing, as in thing bad, meaning body decomposed. But more likely it was simply the man's disinclination to sit down and write that accounts for the shorthand. Later entries show he couldn't even be bothered to spell out canines, which appears as CNS. When a thing bad, the CNS and other teeth were pulled and sold to dentists for making dentures, so as to keep the undertaking from being a complete loss. Body snatchers were common thugs, their motive, simple greed. But what of the anatomists? Who were these upstanding members of society who could commission the theft and semi-public mutilation of someone's dead grandmother? The best known of the London surgeon anatomists was Sir Astley Cooper. In public, Cooper denounced the resurrectionists, yet he not only sought out and retained their services, but encouraged those in his employ to take up the job. Thing bad. Cooper was an outspoken defender of human dissection. "He must mangle the living if he has not operated on the dead," was his famous line. While his point is well taken and the medical school's plight was a difficult one, a little conscience would have served. Cooper was the type of man who not only evinced no compunction about cutting up strangers' family members, but happily sliced into his own former patients. He kept in touch with the family doctors of those he had operated on, and upon hearing of their passing, commissioned his resurrectionist to unearth them so that he might have a look at how his handiwork had held up. He paid for the retrieval of bodies of colleagues' patients known to have interesting ailments or anatomical peculiarities. He was a man in whom a healthy passion for biology seemed to have metastasized into a sort of macabre eccentricity. In Things for the Surgeon, an account of body snatching by Hubert Cole, Sir Astley is said to have painted the names of colleagues onto pieces of bone and forced lab dogs to swallow them, so that when the bone was extracted during the dog's dissection, the colleague's name would appear in intaglio, the bone around the letters having been eaten away by the dog's gastric acids. The items were handed out as humorous gifts. Cole doesn't mention the colleague's reactions to the one-of-a-kind nameplates, but I would hazard a guess that the men made an effort to enjoy the joke and displayed the items prominently, at least when Sir Astley came calling. For Sir Astley wasn't the sort of fellow whose ill will you wanted to take with you to your grave. As Sir Astley himself put it, "I can get anyone." Like the resurrectionists, the anatomists were men who had clearly been successful in objectifying, in their own minds at least, the dead human body. Not only did they view dissection and the study of anatomy as justification for unapproved disinterment, they saw no reason to treat the unearthed dead as entities worthy of respect. It didn't bother them that the corpses would arrive at their doors, to quote Ruth Richardson, compressed into boxes, packed in sawdust, trussed up in sacks, roped up like hams. So similar in their treatment were the dead to ordinary items of commerce that every now and then boxes would be mixed up in transit. James Moores Ball, author of The Sack-'em-up Men, tells the tale of the flummoxed anatomist who opened a crate delivered to his lab expecting a cadaver but found instead a very fine ham, a large cheese, a basket of eggs, and a huge ball of yarn. One can only imagine the surprise and very special disappointment of the party expecting very fine ham, cheese, eggs, or a huge ball of yarn, who found instead a well-packed but quite dead Englishman. It wasn't so much the actual dissecting that smacked of disrespect. It was the whole street theater-cum-abattoir air of the proceedings. Engravings by Thomas Rowlandson and William Hogarth of 18th and early 19th century dissecting rooms show cadavers' intestines hanging like parade streamers off the sides of tables, skulls bobbing in boiling pots, organs strewn on the floor, being eaten by dogs. In the background, crowds of men gawk and leer. While the artists were clearly editorializing upon the practice of dissection, written sources suggest the artworks were not far removed from the truth. Here's the composer Hector Berlioz in an 1822 entry in his memoirs, shedding considerable light on his decision to pursue music rather than medicine. Robert took me for the first time to the dissecting room. At the sight of that terrible charnel house, fragments of limbs, the grinning heads and gaping skulls, the bloody quagmire underfoot and the atrocious smell it gave off, the swarms of sparrows wrangling over scraps of lung, the rats in their corner gnawing the bleeding vertebrae, such a feeling of revulsion possessed me that I leaped through the window of the dissecting room and fled for home as though death and all his hideous train were at my heels. And I would wager a fine ham and a huge ball of yarn that no anatomist of that era ever held a memorial service for the leftover pieces. Cadaver remainders were buried not out of respect but for lack of other options. The burials were hastily done, always at night, and usually out behind the building. To avoid the problematic odors that tend to accompany a shallow burial, anatomists came up with some creative solutions to the flesh disposal problem. A persistent rumor had them in cahoots with the keepers of London's wild animal menageries. Others were said to keep vultures on hand for the task, though if Berlioz is to be believed, the sparrows of the day were well up to the task. Richardson came across a reference to anatomists cooking down human bones and fat into a substance like spermaceti, which they used to make candles and soap. Whether these were used in the anatomist's homes or given away as gifts was not noted, but between these and the gastric juice-etched nameplates, it's safe to say you really didn't want your name on an anatomist's Christmas gift list. And so it went. For nearly a century, the shortage of legally dissectable bodies pitted the anatomist against the private citizen. By and large, it was the poor who had most to lose. For over time, entrepreneurs came up with an arsenal of anti-resurrectionist products and services, affordable only by the upper class. Iron cages, called mort safes, could be set in concrete above the grave or underground around the coffin. Churches in Scotland built graveyard dead houses, locked buildings where a body could be left to decompose until its structures and organs had disintegrated to the point where they were of no use to anatomists. You could buy patented spring closure coffins, coffins outfitted with cast-iron corpse straps, double and even triple coffins. Appropriately, the anatomists were among the undertaker's best customers. Richardson relates that Sir Astley Cooper not only went for the triple coffin option, but had the whole absurd Chinese box affair housed in a hulking stone sarcophagus. It was an Edinburgh anatomist named Robert Knox who instigated anatomy's fatal PR blunder, the implicit sanctioning of murder for medicine. In 1828, one of Knox's assistants answered the door to find a pair of strangers in the courtyard with a cadaver at their feet. This was business as usual for anatomists of the day, and so Knox invited the men in. Perhaps he made them a cup of tea, who knows? Knox was, like Astley, a man of high social bearing. Although the men, William Burke and William Hare, were strangers, he cheerfully bought the body and accepted their story that the cadaver's relatives had made the body available for sale, though this was, given the public's abhorrence of dissection, an unlikely scenario. The body, it turns out, had been a lodger at a boarding house run by Hare and his wife in an Edinburgh slum called Tanner's Close. The man died in one of Hare's beds, and, being dead, was unable to come up with the money he owed for the nights he stayed. Hare wasn't one to forgive a debt, so he came up with what he thought to be a fair solution. He and Burke would haul the body to one of those anatomists they'd heard about over at Surgeon's Square. There they would sell it, kindly giving the lodger the opportunity, in death, to pay off what he'd neglected to in life. When Burke and Hare found out how much money could be made selling corpses, they set about creating some of their own. Several weeks later, a down-and-out alcoholic took ill with fever while staying at Hare's flophouse. Figuring the man to be well on his way to cadaverdom anyway, the men decided to speed things along. Hare pressed a pillow to the man's face while Burke laid his considerable body weight on top of him. Knox asked no questions and encouraged the men to come back soon, and they did, some 15 times. The pair was either too ignorant to realize that the same money could be made digging up graves of the already dead, or too lazy to undertake it. A series of modern-day Burke and Hare type killings took place barely 10 years ago in Barranquilla, Colombia. The case centered on a garbage scavenger named Oscar Rafael Hernandez, who in March 1992 survived an attempt to murder him and sell his corpse to the local medical school as an anatomy lab specimen. Like most of Colombia, Barranquilla lacked an organized recycling program, and hundreds of the city's destitute forged a living picking through garbage dumps for recyclables to sell. So scorned are these people that they, along with other social outcasts, such as prostitutes and street urchins, are referred to as disposables and have often been murdered by right-wing social cleansing squads. As the story goes, guards from Universidad Libre had asked Hernandez if he wanted to come to the campus to collect some garbage, and then bludgeoned him over the head when he arrived. A Los Angeles Times account of the case has Hernandez awakening in a vat of formaldehyde alongside 30 corpses, a colorful, if questionable, detail omitted from other descriptions of the case. Either way, Hernandez came to and escaped to tell his tale. Activist Juan Pablo Ordóñez investigated the case and claims that Hernandez was one of at least 14 Barranquilla indigents murdered for medicine, even though an organized willed body program existed. According to Ordóñez's report, the national police had been unloading bodies gleaned from their own in-house social cleansing activities and collecting $150 per corpse from the university coffers. The school's security staff got wind of the setup and decided to get in on the action. At the time the investigation began, some 50 preserved bodies and body parts of questionable origin were found in the anatomy amphitheater. To date, no one from the university or the police has been arrested. For his part, William Burke was eventually brought to justice. A crowd of more than 25,000 watched him hang. Hare was granted immunity, much to the disgust of the gallows crowd who chanted, "Burke, Hare," meaning smother Hare, Burke having made its way into the popular vernacular as a synonym for smother. Hare probably did as much smothering as Burke, but "she's been haired" lacks the pleasing Machiavellian fricatives of "she's been burked," and the technicality is easily forgiven. In a lovely sliver of poetic justice, Burke's corpse was, in keeping with the law of the day, dissected. As the lecture had been about the human brain, it seems unlikely that the body cavity would have been opened and notably rearranged, but perhaps this was thrown in after the fact as a crowd-pleaser. The following day, the lab was opened to the public and some 30,000 vindicated gawkers filed past. The post-dissection cadaver was, by order of the judge, shipped to the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh to have its bones made into a skeleton, which resides there to this day, along with one of several wallets made from Burke's skin. Though Knox was never charged for his role in the murders, public sentiment held him accountable. The freshness of the bodies, the fact that one had its head and feet cut off, and others had blood oozing from the nose or ears, all of this should have raised the bristly Knox eyebrows. The anatomist clearly didn't care. Knox further sullied his reputation by preserving one of Burke and Hare's more comely corpses, the prostitute Mary Patterson, in a clear glass vat of alcohol in his lab. When an inquiry by a lay committee into Knox's role generated no formal action against the doctor, a mob gathered the following day with an effigy of Knox. The thing must have not looked a great deal like the man, for they felt the need to label it. "Knox, the associate of the infamous Hare," explained a large sign on its back. The stuffed Knox was paraded through the streets to the house of the real Knox, where it was hung by its neck from a tree and then cut down and, fittingly, torn to pieces. It was around this time that Parliament conceded that the anatomy problem had gotten a tad out of hand and convened a committee to brainstorm solutions. While the debate mainly focused on alternate sources of bodies, most notably unclaimed corpses from hospitals, prisons, and workhouses, some physicians raised an interesting item of debate. Is human dissection really necessary? Can't anatomy be learned from models, drawings, preserved perceptions? There have been times and places in history when the answer to the question, is human dissection necessary, was unequivocally yes. Here are some examples of what can happen when you try to figure out how a human body works without actually opening one up. In ancient China, Confucian doctrine considered dissection a defilement of the human body and forbade its practice. This posed a problem for the father of Chinese medicine, Huang Ti, who around 2600 BC set out to write an authoritative medical and anatomical text, Nei Ching, or Canon of Medicine. As is evident from this passage, quoted in Early History of Human Anatomy, there are places where Huang is, through no fault of his own, rather clearly winging it. The heart is a king who rules over all organs of the body. The lungs are his executive, who carry out his orders. The liver is his commandant, who keeps up the discipline. The gallbladder, his attorney general. And the spleen, his steward, who supervises the five tastes. There are three burning spaces, the thorax, the abdomen, and the pelvis, which are together responsible for the sewage system of the body. To Huang Ti's credit, though, he managed without ever disassembling a corpse to figure out that the blood of the body is under the control of the heart, and that the blood current flows in a continuous circle and never stops. In other words, the man figured out what William Harvey figured out 4,000 years before Harvey and without laying open any family members. Imperial Rome gave us another nice example of what happens to medicine when the government frowns on human dissection. Galen, one of history's most revered anatomists, whose texts went unchallenged for centuries, never once dissected a human cadaver. In his post as surgeon to the gladiators, he had a frequent, if piecemeal, window of the human interior in the form of gaping sword wounds and lion claw lacerations. He also dissected a good sum of animals, preferably apes, which he believed to be anatomically identical to humans, especially, he maintained, if the ape had a round face. The great Renaissance anatomist Vesalius later pointed out that there are 200 anatomical differences between apes and humans in skeletal structure alone. Whatever Galen's shortcomings as a comparative anatomist, the man is to be respected for his ingenuity, for procuring apes in ancient Rome can't have been easy. He got a lot right, it's just that he also got a fair amount wrong. His drawings showed five-lobed livers and hearts with three ventricles. The ancient Greeks were similarly adrift when it came to human anatomy. Like Galen, Hippocrates never dissected a human cadaver. He called dissection unpleasant, if not cruel. According to the book Early History of Human Anatomy, Hippocrates referred to tendons as nerves and believed the human brain to be a mucus-secreting gland. Though I found this information surprising, this being the father of medicine we're talking about, I did not question it. You do not question an author who appears on the title page as TVN, Persaud, MD, PhD, DSC, FRC PATH, London, FF PATH, RCPI, FACOG. Who knows, perhaps history erred in bestowing upon Hippocrates the title Father of Medicine. Perhaps TVN, Persaud, is the father of medicine. It's no coincidence that the man who contributed the most to the study of human anatomy, the Belgian Andreas Vesalius, was an avid proponent of do-it-yourself, get-your-fussy-Renaissance-shirt-dirty anatomical dissection. Though human dissection was an accepted practice in the Renaissance-era anatomy class, most professors shied away from personally undertaking it, preferring to deliver their lectures while seated in raised chairs, a safe and tidy remove from the corpse, and pointing out structures with a wooden stick while a hired hand did the slicing. Vesalius disapproved of this practice and wasn't shy about his feelings. In C.D. O'Malley's biography of the man, Vesalius likens the lecturers to jackdaws aloft in their high chair, with egregious arrogance, croaking things they have never investigated but merely committed to memory from the books of others. Thus, everything is wrongly taught, and days are wasted in ridiculous questions. Vesalius was a dissector such as history had never seen. This was a man who encouraged his students to observe the tendons while dining on an animal. While studying medicine in Belgium, he not only dissected the corpses of executed criminals, but snatched them from the gibbet himself. Vesalius produced a series of richly detailed anatomical plates and text called De Humani Corporis Fabrica, the most venerated anatomy book in history. The question then becomes, was it necessary, once the likes of Vesalius had pretty much figured out the basics, for every student of anatomy to get right in there and figure them out all over again? Why couldn't models and preserved perceptions be used to teach anatomy? Do gross anatomy labs reinvent the wheel? The questions were especially relevant in Knox's day, given the way in which bodies were procured, but they are still relevant today. I asked Hugh Patterson about this and learned that, in fact, whole cadaver dissection is being phased out at some medical schools. Indeed, the gross anatomy course I visited at UCSF was the last one in which students will dissect entire cadavers. Beginning the following semester, they would be studying prosections, embalmed sections of the body cut and prepared so as to display key anatomical features and systems. Over at the University of Colorado, the Center for Human Simulation is leading the charge toward digital anatomy instruction. In 1993, they froze a cadaver and sanded off a millimeter cross-section at a time, photographing each new view, 1,871 in all, to create an on-screen, maneuverable 3D rendition of the man and all his parts, a sort of flight simulator for students of anatomy and surgery. The changes in the teaching of anatomy have nothing to do with cadaver shortages or public opinion about dissection. They have everything to do with time. Despite the immeasurable advances made in medicine over the past century, the material must be covered in the same number of years. Suffice it to say, there's a lot less time for dissection than there was in Astley Cooper's day. I asked the students in Patterson's gross anatomy lab how they'd feel if they hadn't had a chance to dissect a body. While some said they would feel cheated, that the gross anatomy cadaver experience was a physician's rite of passage, many expressed approval. There were days, said one, when it all clicked, and I gained a sort of understanding I could never have gotten from a book. But there were other days, a lot of days, when coming up here and spending 2 hours felt like a huge waste of time. The gross anatomy lab is not just about learning anatomy. It is about confronting death. Gross anatomy provides the medical student with what is very often his or her first exposure to a dead body. As such, it has long been considered a vital, necessary step in the doctor's education. But what was learned, up until quite recently, was not respect and sensitivity, but the opposite. The traditional gross anatomy lab represented a sort of sink-or-swim mentality about dealing with death. To cope with what was being asked of them, medical students had to find ways to desensitize themselves. They quickly learned to objectify cadavers, to think of the dead as structures and tissues, and not a former human being. Humor at the cadaver's expense was tolerated, condoned even. There was a time not all that long ago, says Art Daly, director of the medical anatomy program at Vanderbilt University, when students were taught to be insensitive as a coping mechanism. Modern educators feel there are better, more direct ways to address death than handing students a scalpel and assigning them a corpse. In Patterson's anatomy class at UCSF, as in many others, some of the time saved by eliminating full-body dissection will be devoted to a special unit on death and dying. If you're going to bring in an outsider to teach students about death, a hospice patient or grief counselor surely has as much to offer as a dead man does. If the trend continues, medicine may find itself with something unimaginable 2 centuries ago, a surplus of cadavers. It is remarkable how deeply and how quickly public opinion regarding dissection and body donation has come around. I asked Art Daly what accounted for the change. He cited a combination of factors. The 1960s saw the first heart transplant and the passing of the Uniform Anatomical Gift Act, both of which raised awareness of the need for organs for transplantation and of body donation as an option. Around the same time, Daly says, there was a notable increase in the cost of funerals. This was followed by the publication of The American Way of Death, Jessica Mitford's biting exposé of the funeral industry, and a sudden upswing in the popularity of cremation. Willing one's body to science began to be seen as another acceptable and, in this case, altruistic alternative to burial. To those factors, I would add the popularization of science. The gains in the average person's understanding of biology have, I imagine, worked to dissolve the romance of death and burial, the lingering notion of the cadaver as some beatific being in an otherworldly realm of satin and choral music, the well-groomed, almost human, who simply likes to sleep a lot, underground, in his clothing. The people of the 1800s seemed to feel that burial culminated in a fate less ghastly than that of dissection, but that, as we'll see, is hardly the case. Chapter 3. Life After Death. On Human Decay and What Can Be Done About It. Out behind the University of Tennessee Medical Center is a lovely forested grove with squirrels leaping in the branches of hickory trees, and birds calling, and patches of green grass where people lie on their backs in the sun, or sometimes the shade, depending on where the researchers put them. This pleasant Knoxville hillside is a field research facility, the only one in the world dedicated to the study of human decay. The people lying in the sun are dead. They are donated cadavers, helping in their mute, fragrant way to advance the science of criminal forensics. For the more you know about how dead bodies decay, the biological and chemical phases they go through, how long each phase lasts, how the environment affects these phases, the better equipped you are to figure out when any given body died. In other words, the day and even the approximate time of day it was murdered. The police are pretty good at pinpointing approximate time of death in recently dispatched bodies. The potassium level of the gel inside the eyes is helpful during the first 24 hours, as is alger mortis, the cooling of a dead body. Barring temperature extremes, corpses lose about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit per hour until they reach the temperature of the air around them. Rigor mortis is more variable. It starts a few hours after death, usually in the head and neck, and continues moving on down the body, finishing up and disappearing anywhere from 10 to 48 hours after death. If a body has been dead longer than 3 days, investigators turn to entomological clues, e.g., how old are these fly larvae, and stages of decay for their answers. And decay is highly dependent on environmental and situational factors. What's the weather been like? Was the body buried? In what? Seeking better understanding of the effects of these factors, the University of Tennessee, UT, Anthropological Research Facility, as it is blandly and vaguely called, has buried bodies in shallow graves, encased them in concrete, left them in car trunks and man-made ponds, and wrapped them in plastic bags. Pretty much anything a killer might do to dispose of a dead body, the researchers at UT have done also. To understand how these variables affect the timeline of decomposition, you must be intimately acquainted with your control scenario, basic unadulterated human decay. That's why I'm here. That's what I want to know. When you let nature take its course, just exactly what course does it take? My guide to the world of human disassembly is a patient, amiable man named Arpad Vass. Vass has studied the science of human decomposition for more than a decade. He is an adjunct research professor of forensic anthropology at UT and a senior staff scientist at the nearby Oak Ridge National Laboratory. One of Arpad's projects at ORNL has been to develop a method of pinpointing time of death by analyzing tissue samples from the victim's organs and measuring the amounts of dozens of different time-dependent decay chemicals. This profile of decay chemicals is then matched against the typical profiles for that tissue for each passing postmortem hour. In test runs, Arpad's method has determined the time of death to within plus or minus 12 hours. The samples he used to establish the various chemical breakdown timelines came from bodies at the decay facility. 18 bodies, some 700 samples in all. It was an unspeakable task, particularly in the later stages of decomposition, and particularly for certain organs. We'd have to roll the bodies over to get at the liver, recalls Arpad. The brain he got to by using a probe through the eye orbit. Interestingly, neither of these activities was responsible for Arpad's closest brush with on-the-job regurgitation. One day last summer, he says weakly, I inhaled a fly. I could feel it buzzing down my throat. I have asked Arpad what it's like to do this sort of work. What do you mean? He asked me back. You want a vivid description of what's going through my brain as I'm cutting through a liver and all these larvae are spilling out all over me and juice pops out of the intestines? He went on. I don't really focus on that. I try to focus on the value of the work. It takes the edge off the grotesqueness. As for the humanness of his specimens, that no longer disturbs him. Though it once did. He used to lay the bodies on their stomachs so he didn't have to see their faces. This morning, Arpad and I are riding in the back of a van being driven by the lovable and agreeable Ron Wally, one of ORNL's media relations guys. Ron pulls into a row of parking spaces at the far end of the UT Medical Center lot, labeled G Section. On hot summer days, you can always find a parking space in G Section, and not just because it's a longer walk to the hospital. G Section is bordered by a tall wooden fence topped with concertina wire, and on the other side of the fence are the bodies. Arpad steps down from the van. Smells not that bad today, he says. His not that bad has that hollow, over-upbeat tone one hears when spouses back over flower beds or home hair coloring goes awry. Ron, who began the trip in a chipper mood, happily pointing out landmarks and singing along with the radio, has the look of a condemned man. Arpad sticks his head in the window. Are you coming in, Ron, or are you going to hide in the car again? Ron steps out and glumly follows. Although this is his fourth time in, he says he'll never get used to it. It's not the fact that they're dead. Ron saw accident victims routinely in his former post as a newspaper reporter. It's the sights and smells of decay. The smell just stays with you, he says. Or that's what you imagine. I must have washed my hands and face 20 times after I got back from my first time out here. Just inside the gate are two old-fashioned metal mailboxes on posts, as though some of the residents had managed to convince the Postal Service that death, like rain or sleet or hail, should not stay the regular delivery of the U.S. mail. Arpad opens one and pulls turquoise rubber surgical gloves from a box, two for him and two for me. He knows not to offer them to Ron. Let's start over there. Arpad is pointing to a large male figure about 20 feet distant. From this distance, he could be napping, though there is something in the lay of the arms and the stillness of him that suggests something more permanent. We walk toward the man. Ron stays near the gate, feigning interest in the construction details of a tool shed. Like many big-bellied people in Tennessee, the dead man is dressed for comfort. He wears gray sweatpants and a single-pocket white T-shirt. Arpad explains that one of the graduate students is studying the effects of clothing on the decay process. Normally, they are naked. The cadaver in the sweatpants is the newest arrival. He will be our poster man for the first stage of human decay, the fresh stage. Fresh as in fresh fish, not fresh air. As in recently dead, but not necessarily something you want to put your nose right up to. The hallmark of fresh stage decay is a process called autolysis, or self-digestion. Human cells use enzymes to cleave molecules, breaking compounds down into things they can use. While a person is alive, the cells keep these enzymes in check, preventing them from breaking down the cell's own walls. After death, the enzymes operate unchecked and begin eating through the cell structure, allowing the liquid inside to leak out. See the skin on his fingertips there, says Arpad. Two of the dead man's fingers are sheathed with what look like rubber fingertips of the sort worn by accountants and clerks. The liquid from the cells gets between the layers of skin and loosens them. As that progresses, you see skin sloughage. Mortuary types have a different name for this. They call it skin slip. Sometimes the skin of the entire hand will come off. Mortuary types don't have a name for this, but forensics types do. It's called gloving. As the process progresses, you see giant sheets of skin peeling off the body, says Arpad. He pulls up the hem of the man's shirt to see if indeed giant sheets are peeling. They are not, and that's okay. Something else is going on. Squirming grains of rice are crowded into the man's belly button. It's a rice grain mosh pit. But rice grains do not move. These cannot be grains of rice. They are not. They are young flies. Entomologists have a name for young flies, but it is an ugly name, an insult. Let's not use the word maggot. Let's use a pretty word. Let's use hacienda. Arpad explains that the flies lay their eggs on the body's points of entry, the eyes, the mouth, open wounds, genitalia. Unlike older, larger haciendas, the little ones can't eat through skin. I make the mistake of asking Arpad what the little haciendas are after. Arpad walks around to the corpse's left foot. It is bluish and the skin is transparent. See the haciendas under the skin? They're eating the subcutaneous fat. They love fat. I see them. They are spaced out, moving slowly. It's kind of beautiful, this man's skin with these tiny white slivers embedded just beneath its surface. It looks like expensive Japanese rice paper. You tell yourself these things. Let us return to the decay scenario. The liquid that is leaking from the enzyme-ravaged cells is now making its way through the body. Soon enough, it makes contact with the body's bacteria colonies, the ground troops of putrefaction. These bacteria were there in the living body as well, in the intestinal tract, in the lungs, on the skin, the places that came in contact with the outside world. Life is looking rosy for our one-celled friends. They've already been enjoying the benefits of a decommissioned human immune system, and now, suddenly, they're awash with this edible goo issuing from the ruptured cells of the intestine lining. It's raining food. As will happen in times of plenty, the population swells. Some of the bacteria migrate to the far frontiers of the body, traveling by sea, afloat in the same liquid that keeps them nourished. Soon bacteria are everywhere. The scene is set for stage 2, bloat. The life of a bacterium is built around food. Bacteria don't have mouths or fingers or wolf ranges, but they eat, they digest, they excrete. Like us, they break their food down into its more elemental components. The enzymes in our stomachs break meat down into proteins. The bacteria in our gut break those proteins down into amino acids. They take up where we leave off. When we die, they stop feeding on what we've eaten and begin feeding on us. And just as they do when we're alive, they produce gas in the process. Intestinal gas is a waste product of bacteria metabolism. The difference is that when we're alive, we expel that gas. The dead, lacking workable stomach muscles and sphincters and bedmates to annoy, do not, cannot. So the gas builds up, and the belly bloats. I ask Arpad why the gas wouldn't just get forced out eventually. He explains that the small intestine has pretty much collapsed and sealed itself off, or that there might be something blocking its egress. Though he allows, with some prodding, that a little bad air often does, in fact, slip out. And so, as a matter of record, it can be said that dead people fart. It needn't be, but it can. Arpad motions me to follow him up the path. He knows where a good example of the bloat stage can be found. Ron is still down by the shed, affecting some sort of gratuitous lawnmower maintenance, determined to avoid the sights and smells beyond the gate. I call for him to join me. I feel the need for company, someone else who doesn't see this sort of thing every day. Ron follows, looking at his sneakers. We pass a skeleton 6 feet 7 inches tall and dressed in a red Harvard sweatshirt and sweatpants. Ron's eyes stay on his shoes. We pass a woman whose sizable breasts have decomposed, leaving only the skins like flattened Boda bags upon her chest. Ron's eyes stay on his shoes. Bloat is most noticeable in the abdomen, Arpad is saying, where the largest numbers of bacteria are. But it happens in other bacterial hotspots, most noticeably the mouth and genitalia. In the male, the penis, and especially the testicles, can become very large. Like how large? Forgive me. I don't know. Large. Softball large? Watermelon large? Okay, softball. Arpat Vass is a man with infinite reserves of patience, but we are scraping the bottom of the tank. Arpat continues. Bacteria-generated gas bloats the lips and the tongue, the latter often to the point of making it protrude from the mouth, in real life as it is in cartoons. The eyes do not bloat because the liquid long ago leached out. They are gone, X's, in real life as it is in cartoons. Arpat stops and looks down. That's bloat. Before us is a man with a torso greatly distended. It is of a circumference I more readily associate with livestock. As for the groin, it is difficult to tell what's going on. Insects cover the area, like something he is wearing. The face is similarly obscured. The larvae are 2 weeks older than their peers down the hill, and much larger. Where before they had been grains of rice, here they are cooked rice. They live like rice, too, pressed together, a moist, solid entity. If you lower your head to within a foot or two of an infested corpse, and this I truly don't recommend, you can hear them feeding. Arpat pinpoints the sound. Rice Krispies. Ron frowns. Ron used to like Rice Krispies. Bloat continues until something gives way. Usually it is the intestines. Every now and then it is the torso itself. Arpat has never seen it, but he has heard it twice. A rending, ripping noise is how he describes it. Bloat is typically short-lived, perhaps a week, and it's over. The final stage, putrefaction and decay, lasts longest. Putrefaction refers to the breaking down and gradual liquefaction of tissue by bacteria. It is going on during the bloat phase, for the gas that bloats a body is being created by the breakdown of tissue, but its effects are not yet obvious. Arpat continues up the wooded slope. This woman over here is farther along, he says. That's a nice way to say it. Dead people, unembalmed ones anyway, basically dissolve. They collapse and sink in upon themselves and eventually seep out onto the ground. Do you recall the Margaret Hamilton death scene in The Wizard of Oz? I'm melting. Putrefaction is more or less a slowed-down version of this. The woman lies in a mud of her own making. Her torso appears sunken, its organs gone, leached out onto the ground around her. The digestive organs and the lungs disintegrate first, for they are home to the greatest numbers of bacteria. The larger your work crew, the faster your building comes down. The brain is another early departure organ. Because all the bacteria in the mouth chew through the palate, explains Arpat. And because brains are soft and easy to eat, the brain liquefies very quickly. It just pours out the ears and bubbles out the mouth. Up until about 3 weeks, Arpat says, remnants of organs can still be identified. After that, it becomes like a soup in there. Because he knew I was going to ask, Arpat adds, chicken soup. It's yellow. Ron turns on his heels. Great. We ruined Rice Krispies for Ron, and now we have ruined chicken soup. Mussels are eaten not only by bacteria, but by carnivorous beetles. I wasn't aware that meat-eating beetles existed, but there you go. Sometimes the skin gets eaten, sometimes not. Sometimes, depending on the weather, it dries out and mummifies, whereupon it is too tough for just about anyone's taste. On our way out, Arpat shows us a skeleton with mummified skin, lying face down. The skin has remained on the legs as far as the tops of the ankles. The torso, likewise, is covered, about up to the shoulder blades. The edge of the skin is curved, giving the appearance of a scooped neckline, as on a dancer's leotard. Though naked, he seems dressed. The outfit is not as colorful, or perhaps warm, as a Harvard sweatsuit, but more fitting for the venue. We stand for a minute looking at the man. There is a passage in the Buddhist Sutra on mindfulness called the Nine Cemetery Contemplations. Apprentice monks are instructed to meditate on a series of decomposing bodies in the charnel ground, starting with a body, quote, swollen and blue and festering, progressing to one, quote, being eaten by different kinds of worms. and moving on to a skeleton, quote, without flesh and blood held together by the tendons. The monks were told to keep meditating until they were calm and a smile appeared on their faces. I described this to Arpad and Ron, explaining that the idea is to come to peace with the transient nature of our bodily existence, to overcome the revulsion and fear, or something. We all stare at the man. Arpad swats at flies. So, says Ron, lunch? Outside the gate, we spend a long time scraping the bottoms of our boots on a curb. You don't have to step on a body to carry the smells of death with you in your shoes. For reasons we have just seen, the soil around a corpse is sodden with the liquids of human decay. By analyzing the chemicals in this soil, people like Arpad can tell if a body has been moved from where it has decayed. If the unique volatile fatty acids and compounds of human decay aren't there, the body didn't decompose there. One of Arpad's graduate students, Jennifer Love, has been working on an aroma scan technology for estimating time of death. Based on a technology used in the food and wine industries, the device, now being funded by the FBI, would be a sort of handheld electronic nose that could be waved over a body and used to identify the unique odor signature that a corpse puts off at different stages of decay. I tell them that the Ford Motor Company developed an electronic nose programmed to identify acceptable new car smell. Car buyers expect their purchases to smell a certain way, leathery and new, but with no vinyl off-gassy smells. The nose makes sure the cars comply. Arpad observes that the new car smell electronic nose probably uses a technology similar to what the electronic nose for cadavers would use. Just don't get them confused, deadpans Ron. He is imagining a young couple back from a test drive, the woman turning to her husband and saying, "You know, that car smelled like a dead person." It is difficult to put words to the smell of decomposing human. It is dense and cloying, sweet but not flower sweet, halfway between rotting fruit and rotting meat. On my walk home each afternoon, I pass a fetid little produce store that gets the mix almost right, so much so that I find myself peering behind the papaya bins for an arm or a glimpse of naked feet. Barring a visit to my neighborhood, I would direct the curious to a chemical supply company from which one can order synthetic versions of many of these volatiles. Arpad's lab has rows of labeled glass vials, scatol, indole, putrescine, cadaverine. The moment wherein I uncorked the putrescine in his office may well be the moment he began looking forward to my departure. Even if you've never been around a decaying body, you've smelled putrescine. Decaying fish throws off putrescine, a fact I learned from a gripping Journal of Food Science article entitled Postmortem Changes in Black Skipjack Muscle During Storage in Ice. This fits in with something Arpad told me. He said he knew a company that manufactured a putrescine detector, which doctors could use in place of swabs and cultures to diagnose vaginitis, or I suppose a job at the skipjack cannery. The market for synthetic putrescine and cadaverine is small but devoted. The handlers of human remains dogs use these compounds for training. Human remains dogs are distinct from the dogs that search for escaped felons and the dogs that search for whole cadavers. They are trained to alert their owners when they detect the specific scents of decomposed human tissue. They can pinpoint the location of a corpse at the bottom of a lake by sniffing the water's surface for the gases and fats that float up from the rotting remains. They can detect the lingering scent molecules of a decomposing body up to 14 months after the killer lugged it away. I had trouble believing this when I heard it. I no longer have trouble. The soles of my boots, despite washing and soaking in Clorox, would smell of corpse for months after my visit. Ron drives us in our little cloud of stink to a riverside restaurant for lunch. The hostess is young and pink and clean-looking. Her plump forearms and tight-fitting skin are miracles. I imagine her smelling of talcum powder and shampoo, the light, happy smells of the living. We stand apart from the hostess and the other customers as though we were traveling with an ill-tempered, unpredictable dog. Arpad signals to the hostess that we are three, four if you count the smell. Would you like to sit indoors? Arpad cuts her off. Outdoors and away from people. That is the story of human decay. I would wager that if the good people of the 18th and 19th centuries had known what happens to dead bodies in the sort of detail that you and I now know, dissection might not have seemed so uniquely horrific. Once you've seen bodies dissected, and once you've seen them decomposing, the former doesn't seem so dreadful. Yes, the people of the 18th and 19th centuries were buried, but that only served to draw out the process. Even in a coffin 6 feet deep, the body eventually decomposes. Not all the bacteria living in a human body require oxygen. There are plenty of anaerobic bacteria up to the task. Nowadays, of course, we have embalming. Does this mean we are spared the unsavory fate of gradual liquefaction? Has modern mortuary science created an eternity free from unpleasant mess and stains? Can the dead be aesthetically pleasing? Let's go see. An eye cap is a simple 10-cent piece of plastic. It is slightly larger than a contact lens, less flexible, and considerably less comfortable. The plastic is repeatedly lanced through so that small, sharp spurs stick up from its surface. The spurs work on the same principle as those steel spikes that threaten severe tire damage on behalf of rental car companies. The eyelid will come down over an eye cap, but once closed will not easily open back up. Eye caps were invented by a mortician to help dead people keep their eyes shut. There have been times this morning when I wished that someone had outfitted me with a pair of eye caps. I've been standing around, eyelids up, in the basement embalming room of the San Francisco College of Mortuary Science. Upstairs is a working mortuary, and above it are the classrooms and offices of the college, one of the nation's oldest and best respected. In exchange for a price break in the cost of embalming and other mortuary services, customers agree to let students practice on their loved ones. Like getting a $5 haircut at the Vidal Sassoon Academy. Sort of not. I had called the college to get answers about embalming. How long does it preserve corpses, and in what form? Is it possible to never decompose? How does it work? They agreed to answer my questions, and then they asked me one. Did I want to come down and see how it's done? I did. Sort of not. Presiding at the embalming table today are final semester students Theo Martinez and Nicole D'Ambrosio. Theo, a dark-haired man of 39 with a long, distinguished face and narrow build, turned to mortuary science after a string of jobs in credit unions and travel agencies. He says he liked the fact that mortuary jobs often include housing. Before cell phones and pagers, most funeral homes were built with apartments so that someone was always there should a call come in at night. For the beautiful and glossy-haired Nicole, episodes of Quincy sparked an interest in the career, which is a little puzzling because Quincy, if I recall, was a pathologist. No matter what they say, the answer never quite satisfies. The pair are garbed in plastic and latex, as am I and anyone else who plans to enter the splash area. They are working with blood. The garments are a precaution against it and all it may bring on, HIV, hepatitis, stains on your shirt. The object of their attentions at the moment is a 75-year-old man, or a 3-week-old cadaver, however you prefer to think of it. The man had donated his body to science, but owing to it having been autopsied, science politely declined. An anatomy